Andrew Finney, and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, a podcast aimed at all nurses and health professionals interested or involved in a research career. This podcast will feature nurse researchers from all levels, PhD students, postdocs, senior researchers, and professors. We hope you enjoy it and find it really valuable. Hello and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, and today we are joined by Professor Gina Owoko-Higginbottom. Gina is a nurse, midwife and health visitor, and is Gina Owoko-Higginbottom MBE. Welcome to the podcast, Gina.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here this afternoon.
It's great to have you, and I have to say it's quite the benchmark for people to have a nurse, midwife, health visitor and of course that MBE. It's going to be a hard act to follow, no doubt.
Well, let's see.
We'll see how we go. So obviously the aim of this podcast is really to try and inspire researchers from all fields. That can be medicine, nursing, allied health professionals such as physiotherapists, but as a nurse researcher, what we're trying to do is to really engage with people from all levels of nursing, those that might want to aspire to be a PhD student, do independent research, or go on to develop a postdoctoral career, or even the aspiration to be a professor like yourself. So we'll probably start off podcasts like this with the same key questions. And I think the question we'd start off with you, Gina, would be, so how come you became a nurse? Why did you become a nurse? How did you become a nurse? And where did that career take you?
Oh, well, if I tell you why I became a nurse, it's not terribly altruistic, actually. I have a multiracial ethnic origin. I have one Ghanaian parent and one English parent. And we actually had a very, very strict West African upbringing. And my sister's also a nurse. She's 18 months younger than I am. And we were kind of looking for a career where we could actually leave home. And in those days, of course, you know, we had many nurses' residences, didn't we, back in the day, before they were all converted into luxury apartments. And I thought, oh, this is going to be amazing because I'm going to be making a contribution to society. I'm going to be looking after people and I can leave home at the same time.
Wow. Well, what an interest. a truthful, honest, and again, just a really valuable insight into why people might become nurses. And what role did you take as a nurse once you were qualified?
I did general nurse training, and I became a staff nurse at Nottingham General Hospital. It seems quite a long time ago now. And I worked on the medical ward in the Jubilee Wing at the Nottingham General Hospital. Again, I don't believe it exists any longer, the Jubilee Wing at the Nottingham General Hospital, because now we have Queen's Medical Centre. And soon after that, I thought, oh, I think I would like to go and work abroad. And at that time, it was really important if you wanted to travel as a nurse and work abroad as a nurse that you were also qualified as a midwife. So then I decided to do midwifery quite soon after I qualified as a general nurse. And I did my midwifery training again at Nottingham City Hospital. So that's how I started.
And when you say nursing and midwifery, and I can also see the title health visitor in your role.
Mm. Yes, well, again, that was a sort of a practical solution because I was a nurse and midwife, was a midwifery sister. And of course, when one becomes a parent, it becomes really quite challenging to fit in the shift working and weekend working. And I was also interested in public health nursing. So I decided to do the health visitor certificate, the health visitor's course. In those days, it was facilitated at Polytechnics. It was Sheffield City Polytechnic because it really fitted in with my family life because I had two children. Yeah. And I wanted to be able to work less unsocial hours, really. And I love being a health visitor. I couldn't believe that I actually was getting paid to study in this Sheffield City Polytechnic and read books in the library. I couldn't believe that I was actually getting paid to do that. It was just amazing.
I can imagine. So when you've got that career that spans three different almost roles, occupations or fields, as you might say, where did the decision to jump into research come from?
Well, although it's you say that my career spans three different fields, yes, it does. But there has been a common thread throughout because I'm obviously my research portfolio, it's been very much focused on ethnicity and health and inequalities in health and continues to be so. And in all domains of clinical practice, we can witness and observe inequalities in healthcare as they exist in terms of perhaps delivery. And if we look at the stats, in terms of mortality and morbidity, we see very clearly that huge inequalities exist in the United Kingdom in relation to ethnic identity and our health status. And that's not really confined to one domain of clinical practice. It exists really in all domains of clinical practice. So in relation to my research, that has been the sort of common thread, the notion of inequalities and how different population groups, specifically different ethnic groups, experience health and illness and receive care. And really, that was not just on the basis of my own clinical practice and my own observations. It was also the fact that I had observed various family members receiving care and, quite frankly, not receiving the level of care that I would have really anticipated. But in relation to my actual bridge, if you like, into research, when I was a health visitor, I started a master's degree part-time, and my master's degree was in health promotion. And I had the opportunity at that time to apply for a position as a research project officer, which meant I was going to be involved in managing a research study on a daily basis. And I could also retain my health visiting post sort of half-time, 50%. So I was working as a health visitor in the community, and I also was working on a research study too. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was, you know, really fascinating. It was a community-based heart health promotion project, and I was responsible for collecting the data, facilitating the activities. It was like a comparative study in two geographical locations. So one location had all the interventions and the other location had no interventions. And then there was baseline survey conducted and subsequently another survey following the implementation of the health promoting activities. So that's how I first got into research. Well, actually, that's not true, Andrew. I'm actually not being completely honest here, because in those days, when we did our first degrees, we could do empirical research as an undergraduate, which is not really allowed any longer because of all the challenges with the ethics committee and so on. So when I was an undergraduate, when I did my BA honours in nursing and midwifery, I did a research study for my dissertation. And I think really that's where I really first got the bug for research, when I was an undergraduate.
And really interesting to hear that, Gina, because I suppose we still say now there isn't enough research in undergraduate programmes to inspire nurses to think that research might be a role for them.
Yes, I know that we have challenges with trying to facilitate empirical research at that level, and many courses do not allow that. We tend to configure courses where perhaps undergraduates are undertaking systematic reviews, for example, or critical reviews or integrative reviews. But I was just of that generation where we were allowed to do empirical research, and I absolutely loved it. And this was my first foray into research, and I, you know, produced my dissertation. And again, it was related to my health visiting practice. It was all about a family health needs assessment tool. And it just was so meaningful to me because it was very much related to what I was doing in clinical practice and how I could advance the practice.
And Gina, can I be rude and say, what year was that research?
Yeah, what year was that research? I'd want to say it was in 1992.
That sounds
like an awful long time ago, doesn't it?
I suppose it does, but more credit to you, because it would have been a harder sort of mountain to climb then, I suspect.
Well, aside from the fact that we did have inspiring, once again, we had inspiring lecturers on our programme who really motivated us and really encouraged us in our research endeavours. I mean, one of my lecturers was Pat Cantrell. She later went on to be one of the chief nurses for England. So they were just, I just thought the lecturers were fantastic.
So yeah, there you are with your role models early in your career. And we'll come back to your research because there's lots that I can ask you about that. But what about that step up to PhD?
Oh, the step up to PhD, yes. Well, after I'd been working with this heart health promotion project, I thought, well, I really like this research. I'm quite interested in it. And I finished my master's degree. And at that time, again, it was quite a number of years ago, it was at the point where schools of nursing were integrating into universities. So most of the registered nurse tutors were retiring because if you go to work in a university, obviously you need to be a graduate. And so that's why lots of people were retiring. And I was actually just finishing up my master's degree. And I thought, oh, I'd quite like to work in a university and be a lecturer because then I could continue my research as well. And at that time, most of the staff, well, all the staff were graduates who were recruited into the University of Sheffield Faculty of Nursing at that time, but only a small number of us, I would say like 10% had master's degrees. And so when I got into the university and I started looking around at the other faculties and the other disciplines, I realised that if one wanted to progress a career in a university, you needed to have a PhD. And by that time, I had three children, actually, by that time. And I thought to myself, well, how am I going to get this PhD? Because it's going to take 7 years part-time. I don't think I'll be able to manage it, 7 years part-time. But I realised if I could do it full-time, it would be much more feasible. And I realised that in order to get a PhD, I needed to get a scholarship. So because I was a primary care nurse and I was a health visitor, I was quite fortunate because around that time, there was a push towards increasing the research evidence base in primary care. And a raft of awards were launched by the Department of Health, the National Primary Care Awards at three levels. These are the precursors to the NIHR fellowships that we have now. The National Primary Care Award had a doctoral level, a postdoctoral level, and there was a chair level. And I decided to apply for the National Primary Care Award at a doctoral level because I knew that with my family commitments, the only way I was going to get this PhD was doing it full time. So, yes. I knew I needed to hold the award in a department of primary care, and I was in the Faculty of Nursing. So I went to talk to the head of primary care at the University of Sheffield, and he said yes. He said, we'd be more than happy to host you here if you get the award, which meant I had to be seconded from the School of Nursing. So I applied for the award, and I was really so desperate to get this award because I knew it was the only chance I had to get the PhD. And so, yeah, I applied for it and I did get it. I think I was, the first health visitor to get the award because before that there were medics, social scientists, allied health professionals, but no nurses.
Yeah, so very, very difficult to achieve, and it must have felt like a real sort of pinnacle moment for your career to do that, because I think even to this day we're still in this situation where most people in any senior nursing role would need a, not so much a studentship, but a fellowship, a little bit like your scholarship, to be able to do research and undertake a PhD, because nobody wants to try to advance their career by taking a pay cut.
No, I agree. And I mean, I was extremely fortunate. Because the National Primary Care Research Fellowships gave me my full-time salary. I had research costs. And I had research training costs as well. It was an amazing, I think it was about 400,000. It was quite a lot of money, even in those days.
Yeah.
So it was fantastic. And I mean, just recently as well, I spoke to Professor Catherine Evans, who's involved with the QNI Research Forum, and it turns out Catherine had a National Primary Care Award too.
Yeah, yeah. And you're absolutely right. It does seem to ring true now, doesn't it, of the NIHR Doctoral Fellowship Awards that we have, the Clinical Academic Fellowships and even their pre-doctoral awards now. We've got the same sort of approach, but probably as competitive as it was for you, isn't it? It's never got any wider. It's always that bottleneck of only so many can get through.
Yeah, yes, but I wouldn't deter anybody from applying, because my philosophy is this, Andrew. These awards are out there and somebody has to get them, and it could be you. So don't exclude yourself in terms of not applying before you've even gone through the process. You know, somebody has to get the awards, and it might be you. Although we recognise that at the moment, you know, it's difficult for us to have a strong representation as nurses in these awards. I mean, for example, I also now sit on the NHR Professorial Research Professor Awards. I've just been appointed to that committee. And really, I don't think I've seen an application from a nurse at the moment.
Yeah.
But why is that? Is it because people aren't putting themselves forward? I'm not quite sure. But we definitely need to be putting strategies in place to support people in their applications and trying to get as many nurses forward for every level of award that we can.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are people like myself who we've had these awards. We've been through the process. You know, we need to draw on all the intelligence that we have available to us to enable people to be successful.
Yeah, and you talked about strategies there, Gina. What do you think those sort of strategies need to be?
Well, the thing is, I always think that you have to consider what I call the three P's. That's the person, the proposal, and the place. By that, I mean the institution. And so, you know, obviously you have to write a high quality proposal. You have to make sure that you are at the right level in terms of your expertise, your history, your publications, your career trajectory to apply for that specific award. And obviously you have to be in the right institution, which is going to support you and has a strong track record of achievement in supporting nurses in research.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you were successful and you'd got this award, did it feel like it was going to be a steep learning curve? Do you feel like you knew what was to await you for 7 years? And the reason I ask this is because a lot of nurses still talk about what we now call imposter syndrome, still feel like research is probably for other people rather than themselves. Did it feel like a steep learning curve to you?
Well, the thing is, I had quite a few challenges because when I asked my head of department to sign my application form, I don't actually think that they thought I was going to get it. So they just signed the form, and because obviously you have to have the support of your employer institution or whatever. And then I was awarded the fellowship, the 3-year full-time fellowship. And I went to my head of department and I said, oh, I've been successful. And the response I got was really not very positive. And I know from my time as a lecturer in the University of Nottingham, and we had students come through whose often their institutions had said they would support them, but when it comes to release, there's a different challenge to be navigated. And the head of department said to me, well, you can't be released because I've got to find somebody to do your teaching. And bear in mind that I was the first health visitor nurse to receive this award. Obviously a prestigious thing for the institution. So I didn't really get one congratulatory note from this person. And I had to actually ask the other head of department in primary care to speak to my head of department to try to negotiate my release. And obviously they were getting the money to backfill my position, but it was just difficult because I was already timetabled in for the teaching and what have you.
Yeah.
So yeah, so eventually, yes, I did get released. So that was a challenge. I think the thing for me is that I never really worked on anybody else's research study from the outset of my career, because although there are lots of people researching ethnicity and health now, when I started in 95, 96, 97, it wasn't really a popular topic. So I the grants that I held as a principal investigator, I had my first one quite early on because I couldn't tag on to anybody else's research program because nobody else was really interested in this field. And in a way, it served me very well because I had to tread my own path. So, for example, I had a colleague who was working with one of the professors at University of Sheffield. I used to be a little bit envious of her and thinking, oh, she's working on this program with this professor, etc., etc. But in the long term, it benefited me that I had to tread my own path and getting my own grants because, you know, I was getting my own grants in from quite an early stage. So, for example, when I was a PhD student, in my second year, there was a call from the Department of Health for a study on teenage parenting in black and ethnic minority young people. And my supervisor said to me, I think you could get this, Gina. He said, this is quite right up your street. I mean, in many institutions now, PhD students can't hold external grants. But I did write the proposal and I did get the grant. I did get the award from Department of Health. That was in the second year of my PhD. So I was doing my PhD and I also had an externally funded grant as well. So when I finished my PhD, I had another study that I went straight on to continue working with. Wow. I mean, it seems unbelievable now because as I say, many institutions don't allow PhD students to get grants. So with my National Primary Care Research Fellowship, with my Department of Health award, when I was finishing my PhD, I had more research income than one of my supervisors.
Wow. I mean, I think you use the term, treading your own ground there. I think trailblazing might be the term I'm thinking of.
Yeah, well, you know, it was a challenge. But I must say, although it's a challenge, I've always enjoyed every minute of my career. I absolutely loved it. If I had the opportunity, I would do it all over again. I loved it that much.
Yeah, really, a really positive message, isn't it? So with regards to what you've just said about your research, tell us a little bit of the highlights and the impact of your research over the years. Has it, you know, when you talked about inclusivity, has that improved as a, you know, as an impact of your work? Has it improved over time? Has it evolved? Do you feel like you've been able to make a difference?
Yes, I do. I do feel like I have been able to make a difference in some regards. Obviously, translating research into real and meaningful impact can take years, for example. But you probably know that I left the United Kingdom and I went to work in Canada. I was a Canada research chair for 8 years at the University of Alberta. And the Canada Research Chairs are funded by the Canadian Institute for Health Research, and you actually generate your salary for your university from the Canadian Institute for Health Research. So I held a Canada Research Chair in Ethnicity and Health there at the University of Alberta, and I conducted a number of studies, one of which was around postnatal depression. And when I was in Canada, I was called to talk to the Alberta Minister of Health, I think on three occasions, to talk about my research and how my research might be integrated into policy. It's a little bit different there, the research landscape, because they have something called the integrated knowledge users. So once you write a research grant, you have to identify your integrated knowledge users from the outset of your proposal. And the integrated knowledge users are people who are going to utilise your research. Mm. So you don't do your research and then talk to the policymakers. You talk to them right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And one of the stark learning curves that I had was, you know, most of our policymakers don't read academic papers. They don't read academic journals. They want to get information quickly. And one time when I was called to the Minister of Health office, at the end of my research study, I produced something called a research briefing paper. We were writing the papers for publication, but obviously the papers take a time to be published, don't they? And so I produced this one pager called a research briefing paper. That's what I called it. And I subsequently had the habit of always producing these one pagers, research briefing papers. And I sent this research briefing paper to the Minister of Health's office in Alberta. And of course, you know, he read the one pager and invited me to discuss the work. And I was just flabbergasted because I thought, well, this work's not been published yet. It's in the process of being published, but he's reading the one pager because it was in a digestible form and he could absorb the information quite quickly. So that was in terms of impact, knowledge, translation and exchange, that was like, you know, really critical learning point for me.
Yeah, and it sounds like that. Sorry, Jean, I was going to say that it sounds a little bit like with the integration as well that you were talking about in the early stage. It's a little bit like how we talk about co-production methods now to inform research very early.
Yes, yes, I think you're right. I think that will be the term. Sometimes we use different terms to globally to describe the same thing. You're quite right. I mean, and to be honest with you, I'm still working on research, and the study that I've just been involved with Professor Hori Sultani at Sheffield Hallam University, we've been looking at the Apgar score and other neonatal tests for infants with darker skin. And the Apgar score, anyone who's had a baby could probably remember, your baby's condition is assessed at birth with the Apgar score. It's been around for 70 years and it's utilised globally. But one of the criteria says, is the baby pink all over? Yeah. Meaning, is the baby oxygenated? Is the baby well perfused? But the global ethnic majority is not white, so the global ethnic majority wouldn't be pink all over. So we're just concluding this study, and we've just delivered the report to the NHS Race and Health Observatory. And I truly believe that this particular piece of research will be one of the most critically impactful studies globally that I've ever been involved in. So, you know, you have peaks and troughs in your career, don't you? And, I'm just so grateful to be able to continue to be involved in studies which I feel are really going to make an impact.
Yeah. Yeah. And I sit here listening to that story that you're telling there, feeling ignorant for the population, really, when you say those, you think, well, of course. Yet we still run with these very, obviously, very sort of these guidelines and these targets and these tools, which are predominantly for white people or white babies in that case.
Mm-hmm. And as you know, we've got these terrible, terrible statistics in the United Kingdom, where if you're black, your maternal mortality rate is four times that of your white counterpart. And for mixed race women like myself and Asian women, maternal mortality is three times. And that includes people like myself who were born and raised in England.
Yeah.
So we still have an enormous amount of work to do.
So where does that see you, Gina? Where does your work end? What do you want to do? Do you ever feel yourself thinking like you were drawing it to a close because there's so much still to do, and I'm sure you just want to be at the heart of it all.
It's very difficult because the thing is, because of the nature of my research program, which is being focused on ethnicity and health, and you probably know that there are very, very few of us black female professors. You're probably familiar with Nicola Rollock's work, yeah. Professor Nicola Rollock's work in 2019, where she identified at that time around 25 black female professors, and only around four of us in nursing. So it's very, very difficult because if you're involved with equality, diversity, inclusion, anti-racism, it's not a job, it's a lifelong endeavour. So when can we retreat from that lifelong endeavour? I still have quite a few mentees. I've got a mentee in the National Institute for Health Research Fellowship, and that's your colleague, actually. And I still have a number of other more informal mentees. And I'm still involved with the NHS Race and Health Observatory on the Academic Reference Group. It's quite difficult because we need to get more research leaders coming through, especially from BME backgrounds. We have 25%, around 25%, one in five of our nurses are in the United Kingdom hold a black and ethnic minority origin. And yet we have very, very few research leaders emerging from our communities. So at the moment, no, I don't feel I can take a back seat. I want to try to motivate, inspire, mentor as many people as I can to move forward, to take over the role so we can all retire.
It's a good job we're not on screen anymore, because I'm sat here with a smile on my, or sitting here with a smile on my face, glad that you're not about to sort of hang up your hat, as it were, because I think you've clearly got a very strategic role now, and you can still offer so much in research at that stage, I suspect.
I do see that my role now is really one of mentorship, guidance, consultancy with research studies. Yes, I do see that. And I'm very happy to continue to do that.
And what are you most proud of for your career? Are you most proud of the work of other people, or some of the work of your own?
Well, obviously, I'm proud that I achieved the professorial role when there were so few of us. I mean, I actually retired from my position at the University of Nottingham, which is a Russell Group university. I think it's 3 years ago I retired now. And since I retired, there is no nurse of BME origin, who's been appointed as a professor in a Russell Group university in England.
Yeah.
I was the first. And since I retired, no one else has been appointed in a research-intensive Russell Group university, a nurse of BME background.
Yeah, wow.
So, obviously, I'm proud of my achievements in relation to my research career, the research I've undertaken, and the fact that I've been able to navigate that path. And in some respects, I have been able to tap on the glass ceiling, and I have been able to traverse it to some extent. But we still have a very long way to go.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it does feel like it's not so much your work is not complete, but this work as a whole is not complete, isn't it? So if you went back, and let's say you had the opportunity to start your research career again, would you have? I know that you'd love to go back and do it again because you enjoyed it so much, but not many people say that about a PhD. Would you change anything, Gina? Would you change anything of the work that you did, the way that the work was publicised, or the impact? Yeah. Is there anything you'd change?
Yeah, I would change quite a few things, actually. One of the things, well, I don't know if I could change, actually. So what tends to happen is, if we have a family, we tend to stay in a particular role because we've got our kids in school and we want to give them a stable family life. So, for example, I stayed in one position for 12 years. But I don't feel I should have stayed in that position for 12 years. But I stayed in that position because my kids were in school and I didn't want them to be sort of moving around the country and so on. So, yes. So sometimes we do have to move on in our research careers. And I would say, don't be afraid to move on. Don't be afraid to leave your institution and apply elsewhere if you feel that you're not growing in that institution.
Yeah.
But as I say, sometimes it's difficult if we've got family, we've got kids, we can't just up sticks and move at the drop of a hat.
Yeah. And then, I was going to say, in a nursing profession where we're still predominantly female, I suppose there is that conflict of interest, isn't it, to some extent? There's that push-pull of, well, I'm trying to be a mother and I'm trying to move up my career on. There's a difficult stage while the children are young, isn't there, where your priorities differ.
Yes, definitely. So, and I think sometimes it does deter people perhaps from taking that next step in the research career. But actually, there isn't any reason why you can't do it later on, you know, when you feel that your children are more mature on growing. The other thing is that I think, although I think I was a relatively good collaborator, I think I could have networked much, much more looking back. But the problem is you have so many different competing tensions with you, like you said, your family life, your teaching, your research, trying to keep all the balls in the air. Yeah. But I think, you know, it is useful to network and talk to as many people as you can in different arenas from different disciplines. It's probably easier now in the world of social media. Although that said, when I was in my full-time academic role, I really couldn't engage with social media that much because I didn't feel I had time to. But I think we don't have much of a choice these days because there are such important pathways and mechanisms for conveying information and for raising the profile of our research and so on, that we have to engage to an extent. But I have to say that when I was a full-time academic, I really didn't have time for that.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas now it feels a bit like a necessary evil, doesn't it, to some people?
Yes, 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 yes. So there's a balancing act there, I presume, as well, really.
So it's very inspirational to listen to you speak and talk about your own work. It sets a bar rather high for people, which is no means something that puts people off. But what would be your guidance to those people that were starting out now in a research career? And it doesn't matter where they are in their clinical career, but starting in a research career or a clinical academic career, what would be your advice to them in 2023?
Well, I would advise you to go and apply for these scholarships and awards, because I'm somebody who has really developed my career through the acquisition of scholarships and awards. Yes, I've had the externally funded grants. I think I've been PI for 16 externally funded studies. But to begin with, I had the Mary Seacole Leadership Award. I was one of the first awardees. I think I was number 3. In those days, it was like one award, and I did a research study with that. Then after that, I applied for a Smith & Nephew Research Fellowship, and I got the Smith & Nephew Research Fellowship. Then following that, I applied for the National Primary Care Research Fellowship, and I got that. And then subsequently, applied for the Canada Research Chair, and I got that. So personal awards and scholarships are a way of developing your research career in addition to the acquisition of externally funded grants. So yeah. I would encourage anyone to look at the range and scope of awards that are out there and available to you, and there are quite a lot, and identify which is the most appropriate for you. You must do your preparatory work. You cannot just apply without giving enough thought and attention to your application. You need to speak to individuals who already have the award or had the award, draw upon their wisdom and in terms of preparing. But the other thing I would say, though, if you do speak to lots of people and their advice that they're giving you doesn't quite fit with your agenda, then reject it. You know, go with your gut feeling. But I would say look at the range of scholarships and awards that are available, quite a lot. Apply for them, make sure you prepare properly and thoroughly, and seek advice in your application. But don't discount yourself, because these awards are out there for you to hold. Somebody has to get them, and it could be you.
I think that's really good advice, Gina. I think, you know, people often have got that little bit of fear of not getting success with grants or fellowships and getting on that research ladder. But even if you're not successful the first time, there's always another chance, and you're not completely lost with this. You normally get good feedback, and usually you can just put that into the next version of that grant or that fellowship and put it back in. So it's always worth having a go, even if you're not successful. Would you agree?
Oh, yes, I totally agree. You need to act on any feedback that has been given to you and try to enhance your work further.
And listening to this first podcast from yourself, and it will be the first episode, you know, it's been really inspirational, and your story of becoming a nurse and working through the different stages of your career and the research, the successes, the bravery you had in going for these things and taking a chance. I hope it inspires people, and I hope this is a good message, not just for junior researchers, but I think a lot of the professors that are probably listening along will be thinking, we know what an amazing career and somebody to look up to. So thank you for your time today, Gina. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Gina. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Welcome back to the Nurse Researcher podcast. And I'm delighted for this first time to say we have Eleanor Hovard with us as our summariser. Eleanor, tell us how you know Gina and introduce yourself, I suppose, again.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be here. Yeah, so I'm Eleanor Hofford. I'm an NIHR Clinical Doctoral Research Fellow. So I'm based at the Unit of Academic Primary Care at Warwick Medical School. And clinically, my background is in nursing. I'm currently on secondment as a research lead with the Policy and Strategy Unit, NHS England, in the Nursing Directorate. So I met Gina just after I started my NIHR Clinical Doctoral Research Fellowship. However, I was aware of who Gina was before I met her, because when I was developing my fellowship application, I was trying to get a feel for who the experts were in terms of health inequalities, equality, diversity, and inclusion. And of course, I came across Professor Gina Higginbotham, and I do remember thinking, wow, I mean, I should be so lucky to be able to actually meet her. And I was really, really fortunate. And what happened was the NIHR fellowship program offers you the opportunity when you're studying at doctoral level to have a mentor. So, and I didn't know it was going to be Gina, but it very much depends on your research area as to how you're matched. So, of course, when I had an email when I said I was interested in having a mentor, I was absolutely fairly gobsmacked and that it was Gina, and absolutely delighted, really. So I've met Gina quite a few times since then in the capacity of being a mentee, but also through some of my other work as well, particularly around race and health inequalities. So, yeah, and I think, you know, our relationship is continuing to develop. So I'm really lucky.
And were there any surprises for you in the interview? Because I suppose that in the relationship you got with Jean, you wouldn't have asked any of those questions, and she was quite open, wasn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these interviews and personal stories are incredibly inspiring, but they also really share the real highs and the lows and the challenges. And I think Gina's story is exceptional, isn't it? In many ways, you know, she clearly has a raw passion and has been completely dedicated to developing her clinical academic career, but not without some really tough challenges, as she discussed. You know, things such as belief in herself, belief from others in her was interesting to hear, actually. I wasn't aware of some of those challenges she had when she spoke about, you know, when she received a fellowship award, and she didn't get that congratulations and that recognition that you would anticipate, I suppose, if you've worked extremely hard to develop an application. She was met with blockage, really, wasn't she? And questioning of, well, actually, we might not be able to release you to do this, which, you know, could be so disheartening, I think. You know, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, what that must have felt like. But I suppose this is where her tenacity must have really shone through. Because you could easily feel quite dismayed and think, well, you know, how am I going to carry on with this if I haven't got that support from the institution that I need. Yeah. So yeah, there were quite a few surprises, actually.
It felt a little bit like somebody was just ticking a box by saying, yes, you can apply for something, but also hoping that they didn't get it because then they would have to do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? I don't know if it's to do with the fact that, you know, I mean, I don't know how many years ago this was, but I mean, I don't think that's necessarily what the problem was, but I mean, I think for Gina, she really demonstrated to them, you know, look at what I can do and what impact I can have. So, you know, it's really pleasing to know that that didn't put her off, actually, because it could very well put you off, couldn't it?
Yeah, and she's a real trailblazer, isn't she? If you think of the time, it can only have been more difficult to do the things she's been able to do successfully. You know, the further back we go, the harder it would have been. So she's a real trailblazer, isn't she?
Yeah, she has really trodden a path for so many. I mean, to become, you know, the first black professor, nursing professor at a Russell Group University, when there are still so few, that is an incredible achievement. Although I say incredible achievement, it shouldn't be so difficult, should it? You know, and we are fully aware that it is more difficult for individuals from black and ethnic minority backgrounds to have the same access to clinical academic career opportunities, academic opportunities, many opportunities. But she has, you know, not just become an expert in the UK, she is now a global expert as well. And, you know, there's an awful lot of navigating to be done, isn't there, when you're developing a clinical academic career. And I think that that came through as well. But also, you know, some of the challenges she spoke about, you know, juggling a family as well, which will resonate with so many individuals, I think. And also, you know, timing, if you're thinking about developing a, an academic or clinical academic career, when do you do it? Is there a right time to do it? But, you know, she just went for it, didn't she?
I didn't have to say much at all. I didn't have to say much at all, which surely that's a great interview. But I mean, I say it sensitively, but also being a female and a nurse, we currently, I think it's harder to be a nurse, to be academic. You know, I think the challenges, the obstacles are much further. But to be female as well in what would probably have been a male-dominated academic circle at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a number of factors, aren't there? Female, she's black, you know, and she spoke of also, you know, the challenges we have as nurses, midwives, health visitors, thinking about the financial impact as well when you want to develop a clinical academic career as well. There's a whole host of things, aren't there, to consider? But she found a way to do it and absolutely is at the top of her game.
Yeah, there's a message of perseverance there. There was a message of resilience and success, thankfully, as well. You know, that was the beauty of it. She's sort of saying, you know, I went for this and, you know, I got it and I went for this. And you have to keep going for things, don't you? Eventually you'll be successful. You have to keep going for things. It was a positive message, I felt.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I think there's also that strategic focus that you need to have as well, isn't there? But the resilience to keep going when you are faced with those challenges and maybe come up against individuals that maybe aren't so supportive of your ambitions. But you're right, you know, her message was extremely positive. And one of, you know, if you don't go for things, if you don't have a go, you don't know, you know, you don't know, do you? But of course, you have to put in a lot of effort. You know, the applications, as you and I both know, you know, require a lot of time to develop them.
Yeah, and that I thought it was quite funny when she'd got more funding than her supervisor within about a year or so, was it? It was far more funding. So that's not easy to achieve at all.
Oh, no, I know. Absolutely. I mean, she really is exceptional, really. But I think you know, Gina's passion comes through, doesn't it? I think that's, you know, you've got to have an intense relationship with your studies for an awfully long time. But, you know, that grit and determination.
And finally, for this summary, I suppose the message that I thought of is that there's still so much to do. So, yes, she'd trailblazed. She'd been really early in recognising that some of the issues, developing those. But you are the sort of, it's you and your fellow researchers that are continuing Gina's work, really, with her mentorship and support.
Yes, that's right. And I really hope, you know, we can do it justice. I hope I can do it justice. And, you know, I think it is really important to have role models like Gina. But I mean, the thing is that she wasn't only a nurse. She also developed her career, her clinical career as a midwife as well and health visitor. I mean, how to pack all of that in and have such different perspectives is incredible. And I think she was supposed to have retired, but she's almost hitting new heights in her career as well now, which is amazing. But I do hope that, you know, I can aim as high as her and many others as well.
No pressure. It's a tough act to follow, but you tread your own path. You'll tread your own path, and I'm sure do wonderful things. You know, equally do wonderful things. It's your path, and with that sort of mentorship and role model, it's somebody great to look up to, isn't it? And be advised by.
I mean, what an amazing mentor to have, and role model for many. And I think through these podcasts as well, it will be really important for others to hear about the career stories, like, you know, particularly nurses from Black and ethnic minority backgrounds who perhaps, you know, have greater challenges to overcome. And I really hope that both you and I as well can help to dismantle some of those challenges. To make things more equitable.
Yeah, and I think that's what we should be looking for in guests, isn't it? It's people that can help us with this, and that can help in all areas of research, and you know, be part of the podcast and spread the message. You know, share your results, speak to the audience of listeners that want to be doing research or want to be doing this in your field, and hopefully be inspirational to people. That's what we'd hope for.
Yeah, absolutely.